Of course, the Mahayana is a very large subject, and although this is an intensive course, and we will have altogether 21, 42 hours together, we will only be able to talk about the basic doctrines of the Mahayana, but I hope that it will provide a firm foundation. I don't want to take too much more time away from the actual beginning of the course, but I will take just 5 more minutes, since you've been so kind to tell me about yourselves. I will also just tell you a little bit about myself and my wife, since some of you may know about my background, but some of you may not. I was born in the United States and educated there, but I am of Italian origin. My family are 100% Italian. I happened to be born in the United States because my father was working there. A lot of people think that I'm American because of my accent. That I can't help that. I was educated and spent the first 20 years of my life in the United States, but in fact I'm Italian. I went to India when I was 20 because although I had been born a Roman Catholic, I was not satisfied with the Catholic or the Christian religion. And after studying several of the world religions, including Taoism and Hinduism and Islam, I was most interested in Buddhism, most attracted to Buddhism. So I went to India to study Theravada Buddhism and Pali language. After I had been in India for about 1 month, I met His Holiness Sakya Trinzing, who is the head of the Sakya order of Tibetan Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism. And from His Holiness I took refuge. That was in 1970. And from then on I became interested in the Mahayana and in the Vajrayana. And my own practice is, in fact, primarily in the Vajrayana tradition. His Holiness is still my guru, my master. I just returned from India about 10 days ago. And when I was in India, I was fortunate enough to be able to meet His Holiness again, and I've had a very close relationship with him for the past 35 years. Later I did my studies in Mahayana philosophy, particularly in the Madhyamaka system. When I was a student at Delhi University, I met my wife, who was also a student there. She also has her PhD in Buddhist studies, and we've been married now for 27 years. After I completed my PhD, I worked for several years as a research scholar translating texts from the Tibetan Sanskrit, Indian Sanskrit texts that were not available in Sanskrit but were only available in Tibetan. I worked translating those texts for a research institute based in the United States. Then after that I began teaching. I taught at the University of Pisa in Italy. I taught, I worked in Singapore for the Ministry of Education. Some of you may know that back in the 80s the Ministry of Education in Singapore decided to teach religions in the secondary schools. So I was coordinating the Buddhist studies program for the secondary schools in Singapore from 1982 to 1985. Then I taught at Fo Kwan San in Kaohsiung in Taiwan. I taught again in Italy. I was in India at the Institute for Advanced Studies, Indian Institute for Advanced Studies. I taught for 5 years in the United States, and then again in Singapore from 2001 to 2004. I was director of the Postgraduate School of Buddhist Studies at the Buddhist Research Society in Singapore. So I have spent all of my life teaching in different parts of the world, and also pursuing my studies in Buddhism in all the Buddhist traditions. In Taiwan, I was able to learn a little bit about the Chan and Pure Land traditions, and I have taught and worked with masters from Sri Lanka and, of course, with the Tibetans. So this has given me a very, this has given me a very broad appreciation of the Buddhist tradition, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and to a lesser extent Chan and Zen and Pure Land as well. So I hope that I will be able to explain something of the basic doctrines of the Mahayana to all of you, and to awaken within you an interest and an appreciation of the Mahayana. So let us all make a wish that this course benefits all of us, you and me as well, because I like to think that the process of teaching and learning is an interdependent one. You can learn from me, but I can also learn from you. And I also want to learn from you. So I want you to ask questions. I want you to participate as much as you can in the discussions, in the classes, so that we can have a real exchange and not just a one-way traffic. Okay, well, I think we have spent enough time with the preliminaries. We spent about half an hour. I think we should begin with the actual subject matter of the course. Now, this course is entitled The Basic Doctrines of the Mahayana, and I think you probably have seen a copy of the course outline, so I won't... Have you seen the course outline? Have you got the course outline? Yeah.
No.
So, no.
Other way.
The one that I sent in earlier, no? The earlier one? Okay, you can have a look. Yeah. Okay, those of you who don't have it, you can have a look at it. I only refer to it because I want to point out that the course is really structured in two phases. This first phase, this first week, we are going to deal with the sutra literature and the Mahayana doctrines as they emerge from some of the most important Mahayana sutras. And then in January, during the second part of the course, we're going to talk about the Mahayana schools, and we're going to look at the Shastra literature, the texts that belong to the various Mahayana schools. So this week we'll be looking at some of the most important Mahayana sutras. But even before we do that, today, and perhaps even part of tomorrow, I want to talk to you about the origins of the Mahayana. And I want to talk to you about the origins of the Mahayana because, as is clear also from most of you come from a Theravada background. And so for that reason, it's important that we look at the origins of the Mahayana, the beginnings of the Mahayana, the roots of the Mahayana. Because one of you mentioned that we don't need to classify, we don't need to identify ourselves as Theravadins, Mahayanists, Vajrayanists, whatever, because Buddhism is a whole. Buddhism is an integrated system. You can't practice the Mahayana without also practicing the Theravada. You can't practice the Vajrayana without also practicing the Mahayana and the Theravada. So there really is no need for a radical, an absolute division between the Buddhist traditions. This division, this separation between the various Buddhist traditions, unfortunately, is the result of historical and geographical circumstances. If we look back at the golden age of Buddhism in India, we see that there, in the great monasteries in India in the 5th, 6th, 8th, 9th centuries, 2nd, 4th centuries, during the golden age of Buddhism in India, in the great monasteries there were practitioners of the Theravada, there were practitioners of the Mahayana, they were followers of the Vajrayana, and they all lived together in the same monasteries. Yes, perhaps they had different wings, different dormitories, hostels, but they all lived together, side by side. And now, with this modern age and modern communication and easier travel, as Buddhists, we have an opportunity to do that again. We have an opportunity for all of us, whatever tradition we come from, whatever tradition we practice, we have an opportunity to live side by side and to get to know the other traditions. And that's very much an ideal, a project that is very close to my heart. It's very much what I would like to be able to contribute to, even if it's in a very small way. That's also why, incidentally, I named the book that you're using as a textbook for this course, The Tree of Enlightenment. That's why I chose the name of The Tree of Enlightenment, because I saw that as an image, as a symbol of Buddhism as a whole, with one root, with a trunk, with many branches, leaves, flowers and fruits, but essentially one organism, one integrated living organism. So that is my view when it comes to the various Buddhist traditions. Now I want to begin by asking a question which I think you have all answered already for yourselves, one way or another. But the first question is, why study the Mahayana at all? why should we take time to study the Mahayana tradition? Now, if we are followers of the Mahayana, if we are born in Mahayana families, if we have an affinity, if we have a connection with the Mahayana, then obviously we ought to study the Mahayana, we ought to learn more about the Mahayana. But even if we have no wish to practice the Mahayana, even if we are staunch Theravadins, even then, there are many reasons why it's important to study the Mahayana, why we should take the time to study the Mahayana. And the reasons are, firstly, because of the vastness of the Mahayana, of the greatness of the Mahayana. And when I say greatness, I don't mean necessarily greatness in terms of quality. I don't mean that the Mahayana is great while the Theravada is less great. What I mean by great or vast is that the Mahayana is enormous. It has produced so much literature, so much art, so many different forms of religious practice. Everything from Vajrayana to Zen, everything from Pure Land to the other schools of Mahayana, the Indian practices, the philosophy of emptiness, the philosophy of mind only. It has produced so much in the way of literary and intellectual wealth that it would be a great pity as Buddhists if we ignored the Mahayana. It would be like living in a house, living in one room or two rooms of a house that has 50 rooms and not knowing what is in those other 48 or 47 rooms. It would be like the National Museum in Taipei that has so much artwork that it can only display about 10% at any one time. The other 90% are in vaults, in the cellar, in the basement. So if we don't learn about the Mahayana, we deny ourselves a great measure of the wealth of Buddhist learning, the wealth of Buddhism as a religion, as a culture, as a way of life. And even if we look at it in quantitative terms, in numerical terms, yes, it is true that the Theravada is dominant in the countries of Southeast Asia, in Sri Lanka, in Thailand, in Cambodia, Laos, Burma, etc. But the great population centers of China, Japan, Korea, and Central Asia, Tibet, Mongolia, and so forth, they are almost entirely Mahayana. So even in terms of numbers, if we ignore the Mahayana, we ignore, and I have no idea what the actual figures are, but at a conservative guess, we are ignoring probably at least 50% of the Buddhists of the world if we don't learn about the Mahayana. So for all these reasons, whatever we might feel about the Mahayana, there are people who feel the Mahayana is not authentic, there are people who feel the Mahayana is not the real teaching of the Buddha. Whatever you might feel in your heart of hearts, still, as Buddhists, as people who want to have a complete knowledge of Buddhism, you need to know something about the Mahayana, because otherwise your knowledge of Buddhism is incomplete. Even if you don't accept the Mahayana teaching, you ought to know what it is. Only then can you have a complete, a comprehensive understanding of Buddhism. We can't, and we should not just deny the existence of the Mahayana, ignore the existence of the Mahayana. So that is my point, first and foremost, that the Mahayana needs to be studied, it needs to be understood, because it is a cultural fact. It is a part of Buddhism, no one can deny that, and it is an important part of Buddhism. It's not just a peripheral or a minor aspect of Buddhism. It's an important aspect of Buddhism. So for that reason, it deserves our attention. I'll say one more thing before I go on to talk about the origins of Buddha, origins of the Mahayana. And that's one thing. In the Mahayana, we have a system of six perfections. One of the six perfections is patience. Patience is a virtue even according to the Theravada teaching, right? We're all supposed to practice patience. Now, what does the practice of patience mean? It doesn't only mean not getting angry when somebody abuses you. It doesn't only mean not getting upset when the electricity goes off or when the water supply goes off. It doesn't necessarily mean not getting upset when your flight is delayed by an hour and you have to wait in the airport for your flight. Patience also means being patient with regard to the Dharma, being patient with regard to the teaching. And for those of you who are from a Theravada background, in the next week, during this week, you're going to hear a lot of things that are going to shock and surprise you and are going to make you think, I don't understand this. This is very strange. What are they talking about? That is when you have to practice patience. Just be patient. Listen to the teaching, try to understand it, be patient. It will come. It will come slowly. But you have to be patient. You cannot get impatient with the teaching. That happened a lot of times. A lot of times when the Mahayana teaching was given, the people who heard it thought, this teaching is too strange. This teaching is too difficult. I don't want to hear this teaching. This teaching frightens me. You have to avoid that. You have to be patient. Be patient with the teaching. Don't lose your temper with the teaching. Don't get upset. Don't give up. Be patient. Okay? Does everyone hear me? All right. I noticed that. Is everyone okay with the? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So now let me talk about the origins of the Mahayana and. This is an important point at which to begin. I think we cannot avoid talking about the origins of the Mahayana. And of course, we could spend a lot of time on the origins of the Mahayana. We could probably spend this entire week talking about the origins of the Mahayana. Obviously, I'm not going to do that because my purpose here is to talk about the basic doctrines of the Mahayana. But I need to talk about the origins of the Mahayana so that you can appreciate where the Mahayana came from. How did the Mahayana originate? What are the roots of the Mahayana? This is, as I said, this is a very complicated question. Scholars are still working on a complete picture of the origins of the Mahayana. It is still a work in progress. A lot of information is coming to light from the Chinese sources. Those of you who know Chinese and are looking for a PhD subject sometime down the line, Chinese sources on the origins of the Mahayana are a very fertile, very promising area. A lot of material has come to light lately as a result of the work of scholars translating Chinese texts of the Sarvastivada school, for example, one of the Indian Hinayana schools. Those were not available, they were lost in Sanskrit, they still exist in Chinese. We're learning a lot about the development of schools in India during the formative period of the Mahayana from the Chinese sources. Although, as I said, it's a very complicated and a very large question, the question of the origins of the Mahayana, in another way, it can be answered quite simply. There's a very simple answer also to the question, what are the origins of the Mahayana? And that very simple answer is that the Mahayana originated with the Buddha, the life of the Buddha, and the Buddha's teaching. You don't have to go very far. You don't have to dig very deeply to find the basic foundations of the Mahayana, the bedrock of the Mahayana. You don't have to look very far. You don't have to look any further than the life, the career, and the teachings of the Buddha Shakyamuni. Now, why do I say that? I say that because who was the first bodhisattva that we know of? The Mahayana is famous for the bodhisattva ideal. The course next semester is the theory and practice of the bodhisattva ideal. Who was the first bodhisattva that all Buddhists know about? Who was the first bodhisattva that everybody agrees was a bodhisattva? Exactly, Shakyamuni. The Shakyamuni before becoming a Buddha was a bodhisattva. What did he practice? What did he practice? He practiced in the previous lives, in the Jataka stories, what do we find? The practice of the perfections, the career of the bodhisattva. How does an ordinary living being become what? Become a Buddha? By the practice of the perfections, by following the bodhisattva path. And what is the goal of that bodhisattva path? The goal of that bodhisattva path is to become a fully enlightened, perfectly enlightened Buddha. So, in the life, the career, the example of the Buddha Shakyamuni, we have the basic pattern for the Mahayana path, for the Mahayana goal, for the Mahayana ideal. The Mahayana ideal, which is to follow in the footsteps of the Buddha, to follow the Bodhisattva path, to resolve to attain Buddhahood in order to liberate all living beings, and the practice of the perfections over many lifetimes, culminating, ending in the attainment of Buddhahood, in the attainment of this state for the state in which you can benefit all living beings because of your attributes, because of your qualities. And this is embedded, this is obvious even in the Theravada tradition. If you go to many, many monasteries, even here in Thailand, you go to many monasteries, what do you find on the walls? What scenes are very often shown on the walls of these monasteries? Yes, they're the Jataka stories, illustrations from the previous lives of the Buddha. So even you go to a Theravada temple here or in Sri Lanka or in Indonesia, and you find what? You find the previous lives of the Buddha. You find the Bodhisattva practices, the Bodhisattva career. And you find that everywhere. What is the most popular story, according to what I've been told? One of the most popular stories in Thailand is the Visantara Jataka, no? It's the story of the last life before entering Tushita heaven and then entering the world as Siddhartha Gautama, the last life of the Buddha. It's one of the most popular stories used to be told at village temples and village monasteries throughout Thailand. I think on the night of the Vishakhaputra. So, you don't have to go to Tibet or go to China or look at any especially Mahayana texts or any special Mahayana temples and so forth to find the Mahayana, the basic pattern of the Mahayana tradition, the basic teachings of the Mahayana tradition. They're all right there in the life and the career of the Buddha Shakyamuni. And in fact, this was, in a very important way, the beginnings of the Mahayana tradition, because people looked at the career, they looked at the figure of the Buddha Shakyamuni, and they said, this looks like a very attractive, this looks like a very noble career, this looks like a very sublime objective, a very excellent objective to follow in the footsteps of the Buddha. This is one thing that Buddhism gives you. Incidentally, I think you all know, those of you who are trained in the Theravada, you all know that the Theravada accepts the Bodhisattva path. It accepts the idea that one can strive for the attainment of Buddhahood. It doesn't deny that. So in that respect, Buddhism is very flexible. I mean, it offers its followers the highest goal of the religious life. In Christianity, for example, nobody can become Jesus. And nobody can become God. In Buddhism, you can become a Buddha if you follow that path, if you awaken that resolve. So that's the first point that I want to make. The second point that I want to make is I want to talk about the, let us call it, I've called it in the notes, I've called it the intellectual climate, excuse me, within the Buddhist community during the time of the Buddha, during the lifetime of the Buddha. Actually, it doesn't, this this climate, this intellectual climate, was not limited to the Buddhist community. This intellectual climate was common in India during the 6th century BC. The 6th century BC was a very dynamic time in India. It was a time of great intellectual, social, economic, political changes, upheavals. There were new ideas. There were new social institutions. There were new economic classes. There were new political forms of organization. It was a time of great change. It was a time of great ferment. A very fertile time, so far as ideas and social institutions and so forth were concerned. But particularly within the Buddhist community, there were three factors, three characteristics that were typical of the Buddhist community during the lifetime of the Buddha. And the first aspect, the first factor that I want to mention is the flexibility of the Buddha with regard to the disciplinary code, with regard to the rules of monastic discipline. First of all, you all, I'm sure, know how the rules that governed the lives of the monks and the nuns, how they were formulated during the time of the Buddha. How did the Vinaya rules come to be formulated? How did it happen? How were the rules formulated? Well, yes, that answer is not incorrect, but what I mean is originally how were they formulated?
As the events.
Exactly. No? Because something happened and someone came to the Buddha and said, "Hey, you know, there's a problem. A monk or these monks are doing this or that, and it's not good because the lay people, etc., etc." And so the Buddha formulated a rule. The Buddha didn't sit down and think up the rules. He didn't sit down and he didn't give a discourse saying, "Monks, these are the rules, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No. He did it on an ad hoc basis. As a problem arose, the rule was formulated in order to deal with that problem, in order to avoid that issue arising again. But the other important thing to remember about the disciplinary rules, about the Vinaya rules, is that the Buddha was in fact extremely flexible. And if you read carefully the Vinaya rules, whichever set you want to look at, you want to look at the Theravada set or you look at the whatever, you will see that for every rule, more or less, almost without fail, for every rule there is an exception. Except for the very basic rules, the rules about not killing and so forth, the four downfalls. Apart from those, all the other rules are actually quite flexible. So that, for example, regarding eating, There are strict rules, but if you're ill, those rules can be relaxed. Similarly, the Buddha, the monks who were living in the far countries, they were allowed to wear sandals because in the far countries there were a lot of sticks and stones on the ground. And so it was not practical for them to go barefoot, so they were allowed to wear sandals there. And the Buddha's attitude, in that respect, I mean, even the matter of living out in the open, living under a tree, you all know about the attempt of Devadatta to create a schism in the order. The Devadatta wanted to make the more austere practices obligatory. That no one should eat meat, for example. That no one should live in a dwelling. That no one should receive new cloth for robes and so forth. The Buddha said, no, I won't make these rules obligatory. If you want to practice them, you're free to practice them. But I will not make them obligatory. So the Buddha's own attitude toward the disciplinary rules, toward the discipline, was quite flexible. It was not a rigid attitude. It wasn't an attitude that said, this is the rule, no matter what the circumstances, you have to follow the rule. The Buddha's attitude was, there are some certain few core rules. The other rules are formulated according to occasion. But you don't have to, these rules can be moderated. There can be exceptions depending on circumstances. And that was the attitude toward the disciplinary rules during the time of the Buddha. Similarly, with respect to doctrine, the Buddha's attitude was to put the responsibility on the disciples, on the members of the community, to understand the doctrine to the best of their ability. In fact, you can see this even in the Buddha's method of teaching. Yes, there are places where the Buddha delivers a discourse and he expounds a certain doctrine. We'll talk about the doctrine of interdependent origination, or he will talk about the five aggregates and so on. But in most cases, the Buddha taught through dialogues. Disciples asked questions. The Buddha posed certain counter questions. Step by step, the Buddha led his disciples to their answers to the understanding of the Dharma by means of questions. He led them. He let them come themselves, step by step, to the correct understanding, to the correct view. The Buddha did not just say, this is the correct view, go away. The Buddha led the disciples step by step to a correct understanding of the Dharma. So again, it was an interactive method of teaching, and it was a method of teaching that allowed the disciples to come themselves to their own conclusions, to the correct conclusions. And of course, the most famous example of this is the so-called Kalama Sutta, the Buddha's instruction to the Kalamas, which I'm sure you've all heard about, no? You're all familiar with the Buddha's discourse to the Kalamas? No, I think everyone is familiar with this. In fact, sometimes this is a little bit misinterpreted. It doesn't really mean you can just do whatever you want as long as you think it's right. It's not quite that liberal. It has been taken a little bit too far by some interpreters. But in general, it does put the burden on the disciples to decide for themselves what is true, to examine, to inquire into the truth in the light of their own experience. Because the Buddha does say, don't accept things even because I said so. You examine them for yourself. when you know for yourself that such and such things are true, that they're wholesome, that they are, that they lead to happiness and peace, you follow them. So the doctrine, the principle of free inquiry, and this is reinforced in the latter part of the Buddha's life also. And then there's the whole question of the political organization of the Sangha, the way that the monastic community was organized. And it was organized, well, I have put on the lecture notes institutional democracy. That's actually understating the fact. It wasn't so much democracy, it was consensus, which is even more democratic than democracy, because in democracy you always have a defeated minority. But for the Buddha, democracy was second best. For the early monastic community, democracy was an acceptable but not a desirable process. The best process was consensus. But the point is here, everybody's point of view was taken into consideration. Again, there was no authoritarian dispensation. There was no, this is the way it is, this is how it is going to be. There was always consultation, there was always discussion, there was always a desire to achieve consensus, to achieve mutual agreement among the members of the order. So these are the features that characterized the monastic and to some extent even the lay community during the time of the Buddha himself. When the Buddha himself was alive, it was a climate in which there was in which there was flexibility with regard to the rules of discipline. There was free inquiry permitted with regard to doctrine, with regard to the teaching. And there was free exchange of views, free debate and consensus democracy in the area of the institutional organization. And these are important facts about the early Buddhist community that you need to keep in mind. You need to keep in mind because they give us a picture of what things were like, what the intellectual life was, what the life of the community was like. It was not a rigid authoritarian community. It was not a situation that was characterized by an authoritarian or elitist dispensation. It was a climate in which there was pragmatism, flexibility with regard to the rules of discipline, where there was free inquiry with regard to matters of the teaching, matters of the doctrine, and where there was consensus or democracy with regard to the organization of the community. Okay, does anyone have any questions at this point? Does anyone have any